The New York Times ran an article last May under the title, "The Internet is Broken." Here's how it started. Evan Williams is the guy who opened up Pandora's box. Until he came along, people had few places to go with their overflowing emotions and wild opinions other than writing a letter to the newspaper or haranguing their neighbors. Mr. Williams, a Twitter founder and co-creator of Blogger, set everyone free, providing tools to address the world. In the history of communications technology, it was a development with echoes of Gutenberg. And so here we are in 2017. "How's it going, Mr. Williams?" "I think the internet is broken," he says. He has believed this for a few years, actually, but things are getting worse. Quote, "And it's a lot more obvious to a lot of people that it's broken," end quote. People are using Facebook to showcase suicides, beatings, and murder in real time. Twitter is a hive of trolling and abuse that it seems unable to stop. Fake news, whether created for ideology or profit, runs rampant. 4 out of 10 adult internet users said in a Pew survey that they had been harassed online, and that was before the presidential campaign heated up last year. I once thought everybody could speak freely and exchange information and ideas, and the world was automatically going to be a better place, Mr. Williams says. I was wrong about that. What Evan Williams, and I think all the rest of us are seeing today, is that words matter because words have power. We see it certainly in some rather extreme and dramatic examples, whether it's cases of hate speech and the rallies of racists that are just filled with vile drivel and hate. We see it on college campuses where there's a need to create so-called safe zones or before a class starts to give what they might refer to as a trigger warning that the subject to be discussed might trigger a traumatic response for people. We've seen it just in this last week with across the society. There's been discussions around the prevalence of sexual harassment due to scandals in Hollywood and many people posting with a hashtag, #MeToo, identifying that at some point they have been the victim of unwanted sexual harassment, sexual advances. But it doesn't need to be the situations in such extremes. Words have power just in everyday usage and the messages that they convey and what we communicate to each other. I mean, think about just the power of a few simple phrases. The power of the phrase, "I love you," or "Welcome home," or "Congratulations, it's a boy," or the phrase, "I hate you," or "I'm so sorry, she's dead." Words have power. In fact, neuroscientists have found that to the brain, social pain feels a lot like physical pain. When you look at brain scans side by side without knowing which was an analysis of physical pain, which was an analysis of social pain, it's hard to tell the difference. A broken leg feels a lot like a broken heart, and vice versa. Sticks and stones may break my bones, and words will definitely hurt me, and my brain may not know the difference. But while broken bones can heal, the scars left by hurtful words can last a lifetime. Words have power, and once they are uttered, they cannot be taken back. Today we are continuing, as I said, in this series we're doing this fall on growing faith. And our guide, the New Testament writer James, has got some important words for us about how important words are for living out the Christian faith in community and in our culture. More than any time in human history, we are bombarded at every turn with words, and we use them prolifically, whether that is through media or just our interpersonal interactions with each other. So please, if you hear nothing else, hear these words this morning. Fellow followers of Jesus, who is himself the living word, it matters how you and I use our words. Through James, I believe God wants to remind us this morning of the power of our words for good and evil, and thus be warned to attend not only to the words we use, but the places within our hearts from which they come. So if you haven't done it already, would you take a Bible? If you brought one with you, great. If not, bring one next week. But for now, use one out of the pew rack in front of you, or if you've got an app on your phone or a site you try to look at, that's great too. But it'd be helpful to have the text in front of you as we're going to work our way through James chapter 3. Follow along as we go. Because James starts by addressing how words influence others. He says, "Not many of you," this is verse 1, "should become teachers, my fellow believers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly." So if I ever take the time to develop a list of verses in the Bible that I would like to take out, this one will be on it. I mean, really, judged more strictly? Like, I need that help. But there's a paradox here, that just by teaching on this verse, you invite judgment on yourself. Let's see what we can do with it. James is addressing a very real situation in his churches. Apparently, too many people in James's congregations want to be teachers. They want to be in the position of influence with all of the respect and the status that comes with it. James sees these teachers using their tongues, their speech, to lead people into the errant practices that we've been looking at over these last weeks. It's the teachers, he believes, that are causing them to show favoritism, the teachers who are leading them to give preferential treatment to the wealthy, the teachers who help them to feel free to go out and ignore the poor who are in their midst that they should be serving, the teachers, like we saw last week, who are convincing them that just to have faith is fine, it doesn't matter whether that's worked out in your actions and your life. And I just imagine what James would say to the internet age that we live in. Because now everyone with a computer or a smartphone uses their words to play the role of teacher, to instruct others, to tell everyone who will listen what they think is true. You can quote me on this. Never in history have so many people so frequently said so little to so many other people. Amen? I think we all should heed James's warning that putting ourselves into the position of teacher and truth teller, of instructor and influencer, puts ourselves under the stricter scrutiny and judgment of God. And so he begins verse 2 saying, "We all stumble in many ways." We all stumble, recognize teachers and others alike. Teachers are no different in their stumbling, they're just given more opportunities to do it. But I want you to notice the direction that James goes with this statement. Because in our society, we like to say things like, yeah, we all stumble. Nobody's perfect. We all make mistakes. And then what we do, whether we say it or not, we're attaching a little rider onto that statement that basically says, and that's okay. In other words, because everybody stumbles, I therefore should be excused and not judged because of my stumbling, because I'm really no different than anybody else. But that is not the way James uses this. James is not letting us off the hook because everybody stumbles. He's holding us accountable. Because we all stumble, not many should be teachers. And because we all stumble, we all should watch our tongues. And so he continues, "We all stumble in many ways. Anyone who is never at fault in what they say," or more literally, anyone who does not stumble in what they say, "is perfect, able to keep the whole body in check." If, in fact, we could remain sinless in our speech, if we could keep from stumbling with what we say, then we would be perfect, full-grown in our faith, mature in our morality. We would become our true selves, the people that God designed and destined for us to be. But because we're all prone to shoot our mouths off and to say things that we regret, we need to take action to control our speech. So he continues in verse 3, "When we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal." Many of you I know have had an opportunity at some point in your life to ride a horse. You know what this is like firsthand, that by guiding the horse's mouth, you guide the whole animal, the whole horse. A rider can lead a horse wherever she or he wants the horse to go and can make the horse stop whenever needed. In the same way, when we control our tongues, we influence greatly the direction of our lives and relationships. And he continues with a second image or analogy here, verse 4. "Or take ships as an example. Although they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go." Even more so than with a horse, James stresses here the size and the power of the great ships, which are likewise controlled and guided by something that is a minuscule fraction of their size. I mean, let's picture this. This analogy works really well for us because of where we live. Because I think we've all looked out onto the Sound, and you have seen, right, the big container ships that come in. Just ginormous ships that are coming down through the waters into the port of Seattle or down to the port of Tacoma. Or you picture the cruise ships that go out of the port of Seattle. I mean, these things are ginormous. Or if you've had the opportunity, perhaps you've seen one of the aircraft carriers, the Nimitz and the John C. Stennis, that are stationed over in Bremerton. These boats are over 1,000 feet long, and they're guided by a rudder that's 22 feet long. 1,000 feet, that is longer than 3 football fields, and they're steered by a rudder that wouldn't fit and fill up one of the end zones. But yet the pilots of these ships retain power over them because they control that little rudder. If the rudder doesn't work properly, the ship veers out of control and it can create chaos and carnage. In the same way, if the tongue is not harnessed, the entire person can be uncontrollable. But when functioning as it was designed, your tongue acts like a rudder and enables you to steer wisely the desired course of your life. And so he adds, verse 5, likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Mark Twain once said, I can live for 2 months off a good compliment. Can you relate to that? How about the other side of that, too? When someone criticizes you, how long does that last and how deep does it go? See, the reason we so often respond strongly to both compliments and to criticism is quite frankly that many of us suffer from an addiction, an approval addiction, that leads us to desperately seek the approval of others. John Ortberg, writing in his book, The Life You Always Wanted, provides some helpful words for a little self-diagnosis here. Here's what he says. Some people live in bondage to what others think of them. The addiction takes many forms. If we find ourselves often getting hurt by what others say about us, by people expressing other than glowing opinions about us, we probably have it. If we habitually compare ourselves with other people, if we find ourselves getting competitive in the most ordinary situations, we probably have it. If we live with a nagging sense that we aren't important enough or special enough, or we get envious of another's success, we probably have it. If we keep trying to impress important people, we probably have it. If we are worried that someone might think ill of us should he or she find out that we are an approval addict, we probably are. Now, like other addicts, approval addicts, we can go to great lengths sometimes to get a fix. Only in this case, we often use words. We use words to manipulate others in our environment to our advantage. Now, most of us can probably readily identify the cases of boasting that probably come to mind when you hear that word as James uses it. We feel insecure. We want to fit in. And so we tell stories about ourselves, and we make ourselves look a little bit better than we are. We recount tales of places that we've been, adventures that we've had, people that we've met. I once caught a fish this big. It's the sea stories. Our accomplishments at work or in athletics or even in the church get embellished. But sometimes I think this boasting can be a little more subtle. Now, recently I went to tell somebody about something I had seen on TV. And I began by saying, you know, I really don't watch a whole lot of TV, but the other day I saw... Do you hear what I did there? I was beginning to manage my image. Because see, I have this belief that most people spend way too much time wasted watching TV. I don't want you to think of me as a person who spends an inordinate amount of time in front of a television set. So I threw in this little disclaimer to manipulate the way the other person sees me. If we begin to listen for these kinds of comments, we'll discover that attempting to control the way other people think about us is one of the primary ways that we use words. To quote Ortberg again, human conversation is largely an endless attempt to convince others that we are more assertive or clever or gentle or successful than they might think if we did not carefully educate them. Words are powerful. And our tongues have an outsized influence on our lives and relationships. So James has some words of warning about our words. He continues, verse 5, He says, consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The tongue is also a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole body, sets the whole course of one's life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and sea creatures are being tamed and have been tamed by mankind, but no human being can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. All right, so James here uses two images. The first one is the image of a great fire. This is perfect for us because many of us have seen these images over the last couple weeks of what's been going on in Northern California. Images out of Santa Rosa and Napa and Sonoma counties. Just horrific destruction caused by these fires that start just with a spark and lives are lost, homes destroyed. Even more, in the ancient world that didn't have the resources to fight a forest fire that we do today, fire was feared because of its destructive power. Likewise, your tongue and the small spark of the words that you utter can have the power to burn your life to the ground, James says. That second image he uses here is of a barely and inadequately caged beast, which breaks out with irrational and destructive power and poison. There's even a touch of poetry in the way James writes here. He says that every kind of beast can be tamed by humans, but no one among humans can tame the tongue. Humankind can tame every kind of animal, but it cannot subdue itself. James helps us see that not only do we use the power of words with our boasting, we also abuse the power of words too. We can be abusive in our speech to others. You know this, insults, the name-calling, labeling, stereotyping. Sometimes it comes out as just sarcasm or scoffing that we do, or that it comes out with humor that is used at another's expense, and we back off and go, come on, man, I was just joking. Similarly, we're not only abusive in our words to others, but our words about others. Sometimes we get careless about protecting the truth about another person and we pass on falsehoods. Hey, did you hear about so-and-so? Do you know what she said? Did you hear what he did? Or we can feel much freer to say things about another person when they're not present. And whenever we do that, it is gossip. So can I just encourage us to be people who put a stop to this? If someone is sharing something with you about another person, and you don't think it is honoring to the other person, or that the other person would want to be talked about in this way, you have an obligation as a follower of Christ to stop the speaker and to ask if they have permission to share this. And as you do that, remember that whoever is willing to gossip to you is willing to gossip about you. In addition to gossip, our abusive speech can come in the form of complaining. Do you know people like this? Do you know people who just always seem to find something that they can voice a complaint about? Do you like being around complainers? Do they remind you of Jesus? And finally, in addition to our words to others and about others, sometimes we can be abusive in the words that we keep from others. We withhold information when we should be sharing. Sometimes that's out of fear. More often, it's out of a power play. Maybe in our families, or in an office setting, or somebody at school, and we give that person the silent treatment. But it is all, James says, a deadly poison. So what do we do? Verse 9, he says, with the tongue we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse human beings who have been made in God's likeness. Out of the same mouth come praise and cursing. My brothers and sisters, this should not be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? My brothers and sisters, can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water. What James is driving at is the fact that our words reveal our hearts. Our words are verbal symbols of our spiritual condition. So your mouth speaks the things that are already present and there in your heart. We shouldn't be surprised when salt water flows from a salt spring. It wouldn't make sense for fresh water to flow from a salt spring, and so it wouldn't make sense for anything other than coarse talk to come from a coarse heart. There's a place in Matthew's gospel where we can hear Jesus say this. He says, for whatever is in your heart determines what you say. A good person produces good words from a good heart, and an evil person produces evil words from an evil heart. And I tell you this, that you must give an account on judgment day of every idle word you speak. The words you say now reflect your fate then. Either you will be justified by them, or you will be condemned. Am I the only one for whom that makes you a little bit nervous when you hear that? Being judged by the careless and idle words you say? Now, most of us have enough social grace to filter what we say. We don't say everything we think, and that is a good deal. But sometimes we do become careless, and careless words can reveal the true character of our heart. What comes out when you're not thinking? Your answer reveals a lot. So let me try to give us a challenge here. Here's my challenge to all of us. Can you go for 24 hours without saying an unkind word about someone or to someone? You think you could do that? 24 hours without saying an unkind word to someone or about someone. That would include both people that you know personally, but also people that you don't, like politicians or celebrities or opposing quarterbacks and NFL referees. Mm-hmm. If you can't do it, you have a serious problem. If you cannot go 24 hours without having a drink or without having a smoke, then you have a problem with alcohol or with nicotine. If you cannot go 24 hours without saying unkind words, then you have a problem with taming your tongue. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in his classic book Life Together, wrote, "Often we combat our evil thoughts most effectively if we absolutely refuse to allow them to be expressed in words. Thus, it must be the decisive rule of every Christian fellowship that each individual is prohibited from saying much that occurs to him." So as we've been doing this series this fall on growing faith, each week I want to try my best to give you something to hang your hat on, some spiritual practices, spiritual disciplines that you can try out and practice and see if you can engage and utilize as tools for growing faith. So three today. I'll try to get through quickly here. The three are silence, secrecy, and sincerity. Silence, secrecy, and sincerity. The first silence, we actually talked about this a few weeks ago, so I won't spend much time on it. But basically, it's the spiritual discipline of refraining from speaking intentionally for a period of time. You can do that formally by engaging in like a silent retreat. Many retreat centers or monastic communities will offer silent retreats that you can go to and actually participate in silence with others. But it's a safe and an easy place to do that. It might be something you do on your own, perhaps on a weekend when you're not in school or not at the office or your normal routine of things, but taking time that you're going to carve out, letting other people know that you're doing it, that you are not going to speak. And I would encourage you also to stay off social media on that as well and not speak and communicate that way. But the intent of that is to notice what comes up inside of you. What gets stirred? What do you feel anxious about? My guess is those are places that Jesus wants to work and to grow faith in you. So a first would be silence. A second would be secrecy, which is not just keeping quiet, but keeping confidence. First and foremost, this can and should be understood to mean that we keep others' secrets. We don't gossip. We don't speak out of turn. We guard the reputations of others. We work to tame our tongues. But there's also another aspect of this as well that's more personal. In our world, again, that is so conditioned and filled with social media, we share everything. As I mentioned, it seems like we're in a time, perhaps unlike any other on planet Earth, where every person can now say anything and everything they want to every other person on the planet. And we've been led to believe that sharing everything is always a good thing, to share every thought and desire and feeling. So the practice of secrecy could be Jesus' gift to the approval addict. It liberates those of us who are trapped by the desire to be seen, to check to see how many likes we get on a post, or whatever it might be. In the discipline of secrecy, we resist the urge to make sure that our good deeds, our good qualities, our good achievements are well known. We may even take steps to prevent them from being known if it doesn't involve deceit. And instead, we let God be our PR department. And remember that we are actually ultimately to do our good for God's sake and for others. So some examples of secrecy could be do a media fast. Get off of Facebook, Instagram, whatever it is that you use. Well, here's another one. Pray intensely for somebody and tell nobody about it. Or how about this? Make a lavish donation to a ministry or give generously to a person or a family in need and keep it anonymous. Or memorize scripture, but recite it to no one. The simplest, though, is this. Just do good for someone this week and try to make sure nobody finds out about it. The person that you help might need to know, but nobody else does. So silence, secrecy, finally we'll wrap up with this, would be sincerity. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, all you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything else beyond this comes from the evil one. For those who have a growing faith, who are living into and living out the kingdom of heaven now, who are walking moment by moment in God's presence, honesty and straightforward truth-telling are the order of the day. Anything beyond a simple yes or no can reveal manipulations or being a spin doctor. Anything more than yes or no often indicates either a present attempt at deceit or an attempt to make up for a past time of deceit. And that is certainly evil, as Jesus says. It's the work of the evil one, because Jesus knows that he is a liar and the father of lies. A person who can let their yes and their no stand alone is a person growing in the likeness of Christ. What would that look like? It would mean that we won't lie to cover up our less than pure motives. Well, I only did that because whatever. It means that we won't lightly commit to meet someone and then unnecessarily delay them as if their time was less precious a commodity than ours. If I tell you I'm going to meet you at 3, I can't say, yeah, it's all right if I'm a little late. It's not a big deal. I won't say, I'll pray for you, and then never do it. I won't try to make my speech sound more religious or pious. I won't manipulate with words to try to convince people to believe us. No, I'm serious, man. You got to believe me on this. We could even impact the rate at which we use exaggeration and superlatives. But I want you just to imagine such a community of people. Imagine a community of people who keep confidences and they guard one another's reputations. Imagine a community of people who are sincere and honest in their speech because they're sincere and honest in their hearts. They say what they mean and they mean what they say. Imagine a community of people who consistently, as a matter of normal life, bless God and who bless other people with their words. Folks, you and I are called to be such a community. Will you live into that with me?